Hi, I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me on the 151st episode of Speaking of Mysteries is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler to talk about Paris in the Dark, his fourth Christopher Marlowe Cobb thriller. It's 1915, and while much of Europe is engulfed in the First World War, while the U.S. is still dancing as fast as it can to remain neutral and stay out of the fray, Bob's protagonist, known as Kit, is an American journalist in Paris reporting on American volunteer medical personnel. But Kit also has another job. He's a spy for the U.S. government. Here's Robert Olin Butler. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and today we're talking to Robert Olin Butler, whose new Christopher Marlowe Cobb book, Paris in the Dark, has just been published. Welcome to the podcast, Bob.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here again, Nancy.
Again, I know, because I am Christopher Marlowe Cobb, also known as Kit Cobb's biggest fangirl. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thrilled to hear that. I'll pass the word along to him. He will be thrilled, too. He might even call you up for a drink. The way Cobb is, right?
I would be there for it. I got to tell you, I was blown away by the opening paragraphs and how you put Kit into the time and place, which is Paris in the autumn of 1915.
And you want me to read that to you?
Sure.
In the dark above Paris, in the deep autumn of 1915, there were always the Nieuports flying their patterns like sentries walking a perimeter. The new Svelte Model 11, called Bebe by its pilots, operated above the high-flying Zeppelins, poised to drop on them in a column of searchlight if the Zeps got by the guns at the French forts to the east. On a November night, I sat beneath the Nieuports at a table outside the Café de la Rotonde. The weather had been unpredictable. It snowed last week, but tonight it was almost mild. It might as well have been April. And that hammering of engine pistons up above might as well have been French worker bees going after chestnut blossoms.
Amazing. And one of the things that I liked so much was that, Kit, who grew up in the theater, sort of reads the waiter's body language. And it's a reminder that the U.S. had not yet entered the war, and the war had been going on for over a year.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that that's just such a fascinating time, and we've talked about this before, but it's a fascinating time to set the story. So are you still as enamored of the time?
Oh, am I enamored? Well, just think of this. Just think of the things that were going on that are going on in the zeitgeist in 1914 and 1918. Violent acts of terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, waves of immigration driven by international strife, the clash between ideologies, both political and religious, racial oppression and gender repression, dictators gaining and asserting power, and the media at the, sometimes crucial investigative and truth-telling and at times biased and scandalous and manipulative. That's 1914 to 1918, but good Lord, that sounds a little familiar, all that, doesn't it?
So I'm
fascinated with that period for, obvious reasons.
And it's a little like Barbara Tuchman, who, what was the name of her book was? A Distant Mirror.
The Death of August, and then there was that other one, yeah.
A Distant Mirror, yeah. Where she's...
Distant Mirror, that was it.
But let's go back to Kit. In previous novels, he moved around quite a bit. And in The Star of Istanbul, he went from Ireland to Turkey, and Empire of Night, the one that preceded Paris in the Dark. It's a much more geographically contained story, and it shifts from Paris to the front, where the battles are taking place, and then back to Paris. Was that an intentional thing on your part?
Well, my whole process, my writing process, is not to have intentions about stuff like that. That is extricable from my sense of the characters themselves and inhabiting their goals and objectives and yearnings and desires. You know, character drives all for me, and the external story and all the things that are, that attach to it then have to be organically connected to and indeed inspired by that, by what the characters are doing and it all interacts with each other. So, you know, in fact, you're having asked that question. It's the first time I've ever kind of thought of that, but you're absolutely right. But this is and I don't want to scare off your mystery readers, because there's a lot of suspense and thrills and, you know, twists and turns in the plot here. But it's also the most internal of the Cobb novels as well. It's the most complex emotionally and psychologically, in ways that are also resonant into the world 100 years later. And I guess because of that, I mean, his relationship with, you know, head supervising nurse Louise Pickering and his sense of who the enemy is and who, you know, and all of that, and even his sense of his own mission and his own split loyalties between his persona as a newsman and his persona as an American spy, and what Americans are doing in Europe, in the, you know, still 2 years before we are going to get involved as a nation in the war. I mean, these are things that drove the focus of this book more than the others, perhaps, into the center of Kit's psyche and emotions and inner life. And as a result, then I think it was the organic, natural result that the book ends up being not quite so geographically robust. That you know, and God knows, though, that the places that he does travel, the, you know, Paris, especially in the dark, the noirish Paris, and the front lines of World War I, and indeed into various, no spoiler alert, specific parts of Paris, which are interesting. All of that is still pretty dynamic, but you're right, and it's a sharp observation, Nancy, that even within the boundaries of the thriller that's the subtitle of all these books, it is more contained and tightly focused. But it's not an independent choice. I didn't go, you know, I don't want to keep this here. It just stayed there.
Well, I mean, the geography may have been more contained, and I did notice that Kit really does grapple with what he wants to do. There's a lot of first of all, he's surrounded by war, but he's going through his own internal conflict. He's going through conflict as an American, seen firsthand. The first thing Trask, who is his boss, talks to him about when he sort of ambushes him in Paris, ambushes Kit in Paris, is that they're on the eve of an election, and they're already working up for Woodrow Wilson to campaign for his second term as president, once again on an American neutrality platform. And, you know, it in hindsight, 2020 hindsight, you can say, well, that was never going to work. But at the time, in 1916, it did.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
But the politics that Kit is grappling with, I found that just so fascinating, because, you know, there was Marxism and Bolshevism and anarchists and the rise of the workers, and this all became part of your story. And the bomb that explodes at the beginning of the book, which blew up a hotel, is blamed on the Germans.
At the heart of this book are the illusions of that are often go along with patriotism and one's own sense of who one is and who your countrymen are, and which all goes down to that deepest of literary concerns that I have when I write, which is that all my literary books, and this is in my book From Where You Dream, which is my book about the process of writing, especially for those working in the literary genre, so-called, is that ultimately it seems to me that fiction as an art form, and it is as an entertainment form too, in a slight, somewhat different way, but as an art form, fiction is it is the art form of human yearning. It is a narrative art form, and all narrative involves goals and objectives and desires in their central characters, which is what propels plot. Plot being basically desire or goals are for literature. I use the word yearning to suggest the deepest level of goals and desire. It is yearning challenged and thwarted, and that's what drives plot forward. And so, especially in this book, where I'm getting closer in explicit ways, closer to that part of Kit than perhaps I've had in the past, where he's acting on an established identity, because that's the thing we all yearn for the most, and always, and at the heart of everything. We yearn for a self, for an identity, for a place in the universe. And one way we identify, we figure out who we are, is we figure out who are our friends and our allies and our countrymen. And so Paris in the Dark carries that challenge within it.
So class, I found, is also very much part of the story. I mean, Kit is, because of his background as a theater brat, you know, Kit's mother, Isabel Cobb, is a famous actress. Kit grew up hanging around in the wings. But he stands outside of the rigid class structure of the time of boss and worker. That gives him an interesting perspective, and I'm assuming that that's part of what builds Kit's character, too. What makes him good at both his jobs, as a reporter and as a spy.
Absolutely. That's a very smart observation, Nancy, because he is, and referring back to, you know, that sense of fiction going forward in a kind of pursuit of self. He is independent enough from all those common identifiers that we grab onto as for a facile answer to a very complex question. And by the way, that's why it is so central to fiction and to our life experience, that yearning for an identity and a self, because all those issues, class, race, gender, ethnicity, politics, religion, in this era, sexual preference, and so forth, it's always been, but it now it's an open question, open identifier. All those things, if you step half a step back from them, what are they? They are ready, easy, prefabricated answers to that question of who the hell am I? And Kit was born into a situation and is living a situation in which he stands outside of the easy identifiers sufficiently that he can take them on or put them off readily. Though in this book, for instance, he certainly is prone to thinking in those ways or making assumptions about those things, and that's all a legitimate aspect of how he operates. But yes, It can be a strength for someone who's living that dual life, but it also he's still prone to inclinations from those ready-made potential answers that are a challenge to him as both a journalist and more importantly as a spy.
I thought of this specifically when he, you know, first of all, Kid is a ladies' man. He meets Louise Pickering at the hospital very early in the book, and he is joking with her because the doctor is a Harvard man, and he makes the joke with Louise if she is a Radcliffe man, and it falls flat.
Yes. Because it's an interesting and complex aspect of Kit, and honestly, that's how you make, and I make it sound like again a thoughtful thing. It's how you let me put it another way. It's how you perceive and inhabit the complexity of a human being, that he doesn't easily become one thing or another, because of this. His mother, who was, you know, raised him alone and was this famous, you know, star, and in fact is a major character, as you know, in Empire of Night, and interestingly, she doesn't appear in this book at all, except as on a collectible card out of a packet of tobacco from the series Stars of the Stage, because Louise Pickering, this beautiful woman, who is also with a man's grip of a handshake, you know, and a very interesting and complex suffragette of the time, she knows Kit's mother through that tobacco card with Isabel Cobb and a Welsh crown hat covered with bird plumes and she's a kind of hero figure for Louise, and Kit can make that joke and it falls flat, even as, however, he is in his independence a rather enlightened man for his times in his respect for the suffragettes, and so, you know, for her, a strong woman aspiring to an identity in that era that involves independence and finding a strength in herself in ways that are not normally ascribed to women in that time, you know, she is also yearning for an identity, and he too, and they come together, and that's at the heart of their love affair, his. You know, in spite of his little awkwardness at the beginning, it has a very complex and rather deep connectedness.
Well, there are two other interesting aspects to this story that I found. One is that even though America as a country had not entered the war as of 1915, Americans were there, and that is who Kit is. In Paris to cover as newsman. He's there at the American hospital. It's where he meets Louise. It's where he meets the doctors. It's where he meets the ambulance drivers. And this is, I thought this was a great sort of petri dish of, referring back to my previous question of class and how going to Europe to help in the war effort on behalf of the French and the British was sort of something uniquely American, that, you know, they crossed the ocean to do this. And I think that impacted Kit as well.
Absolutely. That's quite true. The that American Ambulance Service over there was a place for forward-thinking Americans to go. I mean, if you want to look at the current parallels, neo-isolationism neo-severe nationalism finding its voice in this country. It was an issue in the early 20th century. The outer manner was quite different because he was a professor and a highly literate man. But Woodrow Wilson, was something of a racist, quite honestly, from Virginia, and very much an isolationist. And for a long while, the sense of America's place and destiny in a larger world, engaging in as if we were akin to people of quite different cultural and ethnic identities. That was a nascent idea then, and the people in this American ambulance service were amongst the harbingers of that aspect of America's identity that has been ascendant for many decades after that, but is under attack now, and was having its finding its legs even back then, needless to say.
Well, there's another sort of inside baseball kind of thing that I realized in your book, because you mentioned William McAdoo, who was Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of the Treasury, and also his son-in-law. So if William McAdoo's daughter was at the American Hospital.
The American Ambulance Service, yeah.
The American Ambulance Service. Was that Woodrow Wilson's granddaughter?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
I stumped you.
It did stump me for two reasons. The primary being, I do meticulous historical research. Every tiny detail is made to be right in these books. In the creation of a viable book, especially, given my so-called literary genes here, everything has to be organic within the book. So what goes onto the page has to be there, and that there was the daughter of someone in the American government, high in the American government, was there. I may well have known what you just said, but it would have been an irrelevant turn of the screw to have put it in the book. Now, I'm going to add one more thing, and that is that the great British novelist Graham Greene, and I love him so much, and by the way, he is a man who, a writer who, with the Istanbul Express, Confidential Agent, The Quiet American, Our Man in Havana, The Honorary Consul. Greene was a very literary novel, but all the novelist, and even was in conversation for decades as a potential Nobel Prize winner. The books I just mentioned are all in the espionage, mystery, thriller genre. And Graham Greene once said, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember the quote, but I can't remember the quote for a reason that'll be immediately obvious. He said, "All good novelists have bad memories." He says, "What you remember comes out as journalism. What you forget goes into the compost of the imagination." And so that particular detail of McAdoo's daughter and Woodrow Wilson, I may well have known it at some point, but man, I hadn't even remembered until you mentioned it that McAdoo was referenced in the book. So there you go. In fact, before we talked, I had to go back and skim my book again so I could remember what the hell was in there.
One of the things that struck me, and without introducing any spoilers, is that espionage and these sorts of investigations, they sort of make up the rules on the fly. And as they're going along and they're investigating these bombings, Trask is already concocting an explanation. And there's already a story being placed before he even knows the facts. And, you talk about
facts are journalistic, and everything that you forget, it goes into this, becomes the fertilizer for a novelist's imagination. So, you know, that just struck me as so interesting, that point. And once again, parallels to today, that the narrative is always under review. It's always being edited.
Always under review, and on the basis of political self-interest, the facts are always under attack. And especially when those facts might reveal things that are uncomfortable for those who are in power. And that paradigm, is one of the most basic of the connections between, in this particularly as revealed in this novel, between that 1914 to 1918 period. I'm speaking now of the whole Cobb series, and those same present 4 years in this century. Our culture and our politics ultimately find their own shape that reflects the hard to change inner shape of our human nature, and that's what the Cobb books really, at their deepest, let's say, literary level, and indeed playing out in the thriller level. That's what those books are all about.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that draws me to this series. First of all, you know, this is my podcast, so I get to do what I want. I'm fascinated with this period, and we talked about that the last time we spoke, how we may look at it now 100 years in the past as with, you know, a certain, like, it's really quaint, but it really was a cutting edge, technologically advanced period of time. The technological advances that took place between about 1905 through the end of the war were kind of mind-boggling, you know, chemistry and electronics and all of that, telephones, motion pictures, the very nature of communication and how people consumed communication changed.
Absolutely. That's true. And the strife in the world, indeed the warfare in the world, greatly accelerated those technological advances as well, as they are in this century too. With there's still the one-on-one comparison of chemical warfare, but the technology of communication and information, and as that informs the world events. Today, with computers, is very much of the same, has the same outcropping of human nature, and it poses the same challenges to human nature as it did back at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, I was disappointed that Isabel was not in this book, because she is a fantastic character, and as you spoke so eloquently about women of her time, they were really, you know, Isabel had already taken an independent path, but for the women of Louise's age, it was a much tougher road to anything even resembling any kind of equality. But
yeah, they're still fighting that battle, you know. 100 years later.
As we will continue. But I'm wondering, and I'm hoping, and this is my last question, that there will be another Kit Cobb. We won't have to wait quite so long.
I am hoping that too. To some extent, I think that were all waiting for the audience to applaud so that Tinkerbell does not die. That your podcast and your listeners can have an effect on that.
Yeah. So buy the book early and buy it often, to paraphrase.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. That's you know, that's the strategy. You want more? You got it. There's got to be the powers that be have to be convinced that that's worth their while as well. But I love writing these books, I tell you.
We almost applaud to keep Tinkerbell alive and to keep Kit Cobb going, because the America hasn't even entered the war yet. There's so much more.
I know. By the way, I think since we last talked, you know, my entire archive, my writerly archive, everything that I've ever collected and saved, gathered really, or generated and saved, that involves my writing and my life, for that matter, everything. I had a graduate assistant over several years help inventory and archive and gather together, and the rare book dealer who then took it into his hands. The first place he went was, which is arguably the best place in the world for this archive to be, happily, enthusiastically spent a very fine sum of money to buy my archive. And I got to tell you, if I had the choice of winning another major book award or having my archive end up at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University, I would choose the Beinecke, and that's what happened.
Oh, bravo!
Beinecke is forever. So, I'm there with that. Beinecke has major holdings or entire holdings of people like Charles Dickens and James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence and Ezra Pound and Gertrude Stein and Marcel Proust and so forth. And they don't often buy living writers, but I've got now 69 linear feet in the shelves of the Beinecke. And in those 69 feet are all these Kit Cobb books, and I would love to put some more in there before they have that collection complete.
As a reader,
we await the audience response.
As a reader, that would be my wish, because this is it's such an amazing series. And so, thank you for writing it.
Thank you for being such a wonderful, smart, sensitive reader of it, Nancy. I'm really always impressed with the quality of your reading and the quality of your questions. And you're kind of like my ideal reader. So there we are. Good.